My name is Chris Deasy, and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And my guest this week is Onyeka Nubia, who's an author, historian, and TV presenter. Onyeka works in the area of diversifying the curriculum, teaching history in a way that means we can reframe British identity. Onyeka expresses his concern about how university programmes don't always teach properly and are insufficiently inclusive and are inaccessible to those who don't fit a certain demographic. He talks about some of the alternative ways in which he would deliver the curriculum. We talk about the problem with social media peer groups, how it affects our attention spans. He paints a picture of how these days students want to know the answer without understanding the journey that produces the result. And we talk about an aggressive conservatism that is at work. And we talk about how telephones are the things that this generation worships. Many students fear accessing hardback versions of books. And we discuss how we are thereby losing the pursuit of adventure. We discuss the impact of the legacy of our past on today. The 1970s was a very different country to today, with a very different, more prescriptive education system. Onyeka talks about the books that he read, that his teachers weren't reading, what he'd be reading until the early hours of the morning. He talks about his relations with his fellow pupils, about the teacher who had the most influence on him, in spite of her right-wing sensibilities, or because of them. Onyeka speaks about growing up in an age when it was rare to see any black faces on TV. We learn that three of his greatest influences are Richard Burton, Paul Robeson, and the activist George Jackson. And we discuss whether we tend to look for people who have been through immense difficulties to inspire us to the best of our humanity. And we learn why love is stronger than anger and hate. We move on to talk about the ways in which we can express things that are objectionable in ways that don't harm others. We talk about being influenced by people who have different sensibilities to our own, and why those politicians who don't punctuate our expression, they tend to fade away. And at the end of the interview, we learn why Onyeka's memories are not really positive and how we can draw energy from the negative. We also talk about the relationship between the micro and the macro, and then we find out what his 15-year-old self wanted to achieve and how one in six of the people he grew up with are now dead. It was an immense privilege to meet Onyeka in Wood Green just before Christmas in 2019 for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is my great pleasure in Wood Green, first time I've ever been here, to interview Onyeka. An absolute pleasure to meet you again, because you came to Canterbury about 2 months ago.
That's right, about 2 months ago.
Yeah. And I was really fascinated by your story, by your narrative. I always take the line in these interviews that everyone has a compelling narrative. But what you were talking about, particularly in the 1970s, the education system was just phenomenal. And I almost sort of thought, you know, is this the same planet? And that was such a thought, if you're okay with that, to sort of talk around some of those issues. Do you want to say a little bit first, Onyeka, about the way you work?
So I do a lot of work in universities around diversifying and repopulating the curriculum, developing a more inclusive curriculum, as well as teaching, you know, standard subjects on British history, English history, you know, Reformation, Revolution, things of that nature, as well as the more complex issues around repopulating the curriculum and creating a more inclusive curriculum that actually reflects primary records and sort of depopulates or removes concepts of Victorian imperialism and colonialism from perceptions and ideas about Englishness and Britishness, and about creating a more open perspective in which we can reimagine and revisualize English identity without that sort of distracted perspective. A lot of my work involves teaching, teaching seminars and lectures like any other lecturer, but also research, cutting edge research, some of the research that only a few people are actually doing about repopulating. And that's essentially
absolutely. And I, since your talk back in October, it really made me question what I teach. And to an extent, a lot of my modules are very much grounded in some of the things that I did as a student many years ago. And you look at various figures, even 19th century philosophers or theologians, who are often very male, often very European. And I think that, particularly when I have increasingly diverse
students, I'm very aware that there's a potential disconnect, maybe not even potential, an actual disconnect. Yeah. And it made me look at the modules that I teach and you think, gosh, they're all sort of very, the clusters are very similar when you look at the background of the authors. They're not all that diverse. So what you're doing seems to me really pioneering.
Yeah, the problem that we face is that every module, it doesn't matter what the subject is, if it is taught properly, if you don't mind me saying, if it's taught properly, by its definition, has to be inclusive. There is no module that I could think of that it relates to human experience that isn't by its default inclusive. The problem is that we don't teach properly. We don't teach properly, and we turn what would be by default an inclusive curriculum into an exclusive curriculum, and that's because we're not teaching it properly. So it's not actually about being inclusive, it's actually about teaching properly. And that may sound like a very strange thing to say, but in fact it's true. And if you just take a moment to think about anything teaching religion like Christianity, how can you possibly teach Christianity, the history of Christianity, without being inclusive? And yet people do. How could you teach the history of Islam without being inclusive? And yet people do. How could you teach English history or British history or French history or Italian history without being inclusive? How could you teach or any humanities subject from geography without being inclusive? And to teach it properly, you have to be inclusive. And so what we are actually often doing is not teaching properly.
And I'm guessing that a lot of what you've done is observe, probably from your own experience,
yes.
How other people do it. And you're thinking, I mean, I'm guessing that when you were at university, you were probably very aware, or you're very aware now, that the way in which you were taught is very different from how you think that education should be delivered.
There's lots of ways in which education could be delivered, which is different from what or how I would deliver it. The difference isn't an issue. The intent or the object is.
And I find that my students are often teaching me.
Yeah.
I find increasingly, which is the most important thing. I mean, when I started in this profession, I never really enjoyed seminars because I kind of felt that I was having to really think on the spot in a way that with a lecture you could prepare.
That's the best thing.
What I find now is we have 2-hour seminars as well as 2-hour lectures. Mm. So it means that we can breathe a bit. There's no pressure. If the students give a presentation and it goes on a little bit too long, it's fine. We can catch up. But I find that one of the things that really arises now is not so much let's interrogate the text for each week's seminar, let's look at the content, what does it mean, but also say to the students, is there anything here that didn't connect with you and why? Because a lot of them, you can tell, they didn't like it. But for me, that's part of the process. Who was it written for? Why is it not connecting with you? Maybe I've taught the same module 5-10 years before, and it did connect with the students in a different way. So what's changed?
Have you seen those sort of patterns? There's a lot of things here. There is a sense in which the subjects that we teach, especially in humanities, if you're talking about theology or geography or history, in which those subjects are just missing large sections in terms of their methodology and in terms of their historiography, so they're just simply not comprehensive. Okay, there is that, and by them not being comprehensive, they are inaccessible to those people who don't fit a certain demographic, because they were created to fit a certain demographic and for people from a certain demographic. There is that, okay? And there was also a perspective in which, as a result, the methodology or the historiography of teaching those subjects has been heavily influenced by the need to fulfill a requirement of that demographic. So, a certain class, a certain ethnicity, a certain gender, sex, what have you. And it only works for them. That's understandable too. However, there is also the matter of the dumbing down of intellectual pursuit by the sort of aggressive march of social myopism, I would say. Many people are now being bombarded by a social revolution which is teaching them to orientate themselves within social media peer groups which have perhaps no evidence based understanding in which everything is based on emotional acceptance within a small peer group. That influences how people see things, how they understand things, the capacity for in-depth intellectual cognitive pursuits is being restricted, the attention span, the capacity to be able to read a book, the capacity to be able to read a book from cover to cover is being more and more restricted, limited, reduced. Capacity for reflective thought, to contrast your own thought processes and provide analysis of your own thought processes being reduced. The historiography of people's own capacity is also being reduced. The reference points that people have to make sense of the world are being taken away from them, so that they are constantly dwelling in the concepts of modernity. The courage to be able to pursue intellectually aggressive methodology of seeking knowledge is being reduced in the way of, I just want the answer, tell me the answer. And if you can't tell me the answer, just give me to somebody else who can tell me the answer, without understanding that the actual pursuit of intelligence is a journey, and there may not be an answer that you're looking for. I just want an answer, people often say, without understanding that it is the journey that produces the result. And that what we want to see is the journey and evidence of the journey, perhaps with signposts. It's not going to be entirely woolly, but it's going to be a journey. And this is very, very difficult for many modern students. Very, very difficult, lacking in reference points.
What do you think has changed for students now? Do you think that it was different 10 or 15 years ago?
I feel that they're cut off from any part of the world that is not part of the digital revolution. And they feel they are constantly under pressure to conform, and a conservatism, an aggressive conservatism, which teaches them to conform, even if the conforming is to something that we who are outside of that demographic may regard as ridiculous. To them it is deadly, 100% serious. And if they don't conform, they may lose their life. May lose their friends. And for them, losing their friends, losing their social media contacts is everything. Yeah. Their world revolves around that telephone, that little machine, that texting telephone machine. And without that machine, they can't function. Yeah. It is their god, almost. And that thing they worship. It gives them information. They look for direction from it. It gives them entertainment. It gives them everything that they need. They even pay. They pay their bills with it. It's everything. And the moment that they lose that, everything is gone. So their machine has become their god. And this is very worrying, I think.
I mean, do you find that there are steps that could be taken within higher education to ensure that students can in some way be, for want of a better word, recalibrated? I mean, is there a reset button that can be pressed? Because, I mean, one of the things that's pretty obvious with it, the pluses and minuses, we can say to students now, don't worry if the core text is not in the library, because here's a digital version. You can access it on your phone, and they'll read it from the phone in their class. On the other hand, it means that a number of students who will just restrict themselves to the material that we provide online,
only,
rather than browse the shelves.
Yeah, they feel afraid. Many students have genuine anxiety and fear, and are absolutely terrified by the idea of consulting a paper hardback or softback version of a book. They genuinely have anxiety. Genuine. It's not pretend. They say, well, what do I do? I just want the answer. I just want the book. What's all these other books? But what if I can't get that book? Without having that kind of that desire or that pursuit. Even if I can't find that book, I might find another book that's actually more relevant. The books that we put on our reading list are but a tiny proportion of those books that you could look at, and they might find two or three other books that are more appropriate than the one that's in the essential reading, and we hope that they do. But that pursuit can only be gained as an adventurer. The pursuit of adventure is being weeded out because answers are expected to be immediate and produce results that are immediate, and if they're not immediate, then anxiety kicks in, And students may feel, if I haven't got those exact pages electronically, then I haven't got the exact answer. I want an exact answer that's immediate, that I can immediately download. But then the difficulty comes in, how do you extend that? That was the question, yeah. I think it was. I think one has to challenge, but then in challenging, anxiety kicks in for the student. Students go through genuine puzzles, and then students may feel, well, taking the shortcut, that I don't need to really concentrate on that until the exam. The exam, you know, it's all about what I get marked, without understanding that there's a continuity and a relationship between the exam, coursework and everything else, and the pursuit of reading and the pursuit of adventuring. And one can see in one's writing for essay writing, exam, dissertation, whether one has gone through that process or not. So there is no shortcut, but there's an expectation of shortcuts, and in a way we have been responsible for helping to facilitate that. Sometimes I think we need to say, no, it's not going to be easy. No, you're going to suffer from anxiety. And we're going to obviously provide mechanisms to help you overcome that anxiety, but some of that anxiety is natural. Some of that feeling of lost, it is also it has to be managed, of course. May also be necessary, and also may be appropriate. Some of that feeling of not knowing is actually a good thing.
Yeah, and actually I do find sometimes that we have students with what's called an inclusive learning plan, whereby it might be, for example, that they're not expected to contribute in class, or we're not allowed to ask them specifically a question. But they're often the first to put their hands up when you say, for example, would anyone like to read this quotation on the screen? Or, you know, so they will often be the first to volunteer.
Yeah.
So it shows that sometimes, because they know I'm not going to ask them,
All the more reason to ask.
Yeah, and is that something that you've picked up on as well?
Yeah, we have very low expectations. Yeah. We can't. We have to know the challenges that young people face, but we have to also have high expectations and hope that they will achieve. Also acknowledging that the obstacles that they will face. But I think we can't just simply say, for example, people say you can't teach Shakespeare to a younger generation. Why can't you teach Shakespeare? Why can't you? Oh, the language is too difficult. Why is it too difficult? You know, it is if you don't understand how to teach it.
Oh, yeah.
Then that's a question of your capacity to be able to facilitate, not necessarily their capacity to receive. You know, you can teach all kinds of complex texts, from classical texts, from Ovid to the Iliad, if you know how to do it. There's ways of doing it. And if you've got enough time, obviously, sometimes we don't have enough time. Sometimes we're bounded by, you know, the need to produce a curriculum, the need to achieve a certain result. But if you have enough time and you have enough skill, you can do it. I think it might not be easy, but you can do it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. When I was in secondary school, there were some very good, I mean, admittedly, some of the best teachers were those, looking back, they didn't really stick to the curriculum.
Of course.
You know, we'd have debates in class, and we loved it, and they made the subject really come alive.
Yes.
There'd be another teacher who would literally do it by the book. There was an English teacher who was renowned for going through, and if you put some factually correct information into your analysis of, say, Shakespeare, you get points. So as long as you said factually correct things, you could end up with 8 out of 8 or whatever it was marked out of.
Yes.
But if you put in an opinion, then it was deemed to be superfluous.
Okay,
and inevitably often incorrect.
Indeed.
And so the number of people who said, oh, I hate English, because, and of course their reason for hating English was because they had a terrible teacher.
Indeed,
not because of the text in itself.
Certainly.
So hating Shakespeare means I hate the way Shakespeare was taught.
Indeed, yes, that's right, very true.
I mean, something that I mean, obviously, one of the questions I will ask a bit later is whether you could ever have imagined, when you say were you a teenage, what you're doing now. But what about in terms of your own childhood or educational journey? I mean, you've obviously effectively critiqued the way in which some of the implicit assumptions, or some of the ways in which material is delivered, and the accessibility of that and the diversity around that. But do you, in terms of your own background, what do you particularly remember from childhood, from school? What are the sort of things that stand out now as perhaps being particularly either incongruous or something that has really paved the way for you to do the kind of pioneering work you're doing now?
Thank you. It's a very good question, Chris. I think the way in which I see things now, or even what I'm doing, or even the way in which the world is now, is that, you know, a reflection of the past. It's part of a legacy of the past. And I think about how especially during the 70s, how it was a very different country in many ways from how it is now, and the way in which the education system was actually quite prescriptive, exclusive, restricted, limited in its scope and objectives, and also in terms of information, quite restricted too, and also how things weren't actually taught properly, but there was nevertheless a sort of methodology which was quite forceful. In some ways, that forcefulness and structure has been useful in terms of the framing of certain historical disciplines, certain discipline, academic discipline, the ability to learn things by rote, the ability to learn dates by rote, the ability to understand history from a traditional perspective, and to be able to quote from those traditional perspectives, actually in some ways is a plus, because I feel you can't critique something unless you know it. So having that traditional historical background, learning, you know, the names of all the kings and queens of England, learning without necessarily learning about social history, but learning it by date, actually is useful, because when you then do social history, you at least have a date time framework to relate the social history to. The problem may be if you're trying to critique something, add to it without having that background. So I'm in some ways I'm indebted to that education, even though it was decidedly misogynistic, racist, sexist, homophobic, and every classist and everything else. It actually was extremely useful in creating historical frameworks, time references, time periods, structures, and shape to my discourse. The question is, could that discourse have been delivered without all the other stuff? Yeah. I don't know, because at the moment what we do, we often deliver concepts and ideas, but without reference points. Yeah. So people don't have time period reference points. People don't know when the Ottomans conquered Constantinople. They don't know when the medieval period begins and it ends, or the Middle Ages, or the Dark Ages, so-called Dark Ages, or, you know, what does BC mean? Yeah. Or BCE? Or what does CE mean? They don't know these things. 2,000 years, 4,000 years, they haven't got a concept of these things. And they can't place, because we teach them, because we always say it's concepts, it's ideas, it's principles. Whereas in fact, sometimes they might need to know. Even if they're going to later on say, oh, we need to question that, at least they've got something to question. But often they don't know what they're questioning. Yeah.
And I'm guessing that you thought as well that the teachers from that era probably didn't really understand what they were teaching either, in the respect that they were no doubt adhering to some form of a curriculum, but it's the whole sort of seeing the wood for the trees.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my sense. There were some teachers who were well known for sort of deviating from a curriculum because they didn't really get it. I mean, the transition from O-level to GCSE was a case in point. We lost a lot of teachers from that sort of era.
Yes.
And I mean, it's interesting that obviously now that I work in academia, I'm very aware that sometimes you are teaching outside of your comfort zone. But when you're young, and this is the great difference between being a teenager and being an adult in education, is that when you're a lot younger, you look up to those teachers as role models. You see them as the authority, because they are the ones who will determine, you know, if something is, back to our previous discussion, if something is right or wrong.
Yeah.
And they become the authority.
Did you have that? I didn't. My understanding from very young was a belief that education is an exploration. I understood that my teachers were on a different part of the journey than I was at 10 or 12, but I had no belief that they were the absolute. That's a different kind of perspective. That doesn't mean that I wasn't respectful, because sometimes people say, I showed very much respect and even deference to them, but I was in no belief that they had ultimate truth. I did not believe that. It was slightly different for me. So, for example, and teachers can tell that. You know, if there's one child in the class, he or she may say, okay, but they know, okay, you have a question, don't you? Come and see me after. And so I was in no way, I had a much more, but that's because I had access to books. And so often I was reading the books that my teachers weren't reading from a very, very young age, and reading them from cover to cover. I used to read them in my lunchtime when other kids were out in the school playground. I used to read them after class. And when I finished my schoolwork, I'd be reading beyond. I remember a teacher, we had to at one point read The Hobbit, I think it was, you know, J.R. Tolkien's book. She said, "Oh yeah, you know, you need to read Hobbit." And she saw me afterwards. She said, "Oh yes, Anya, if you really want to take this further, of course you should read Lord of the Rings." But by the time she'd already said that, I read Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion.
Yeah.
And The Silmarillion, which is the book written, you know, which talks about, I don't know if you know those books. The Silmarillion is a more convoluted, complex story that talks about the genesis of his world. It's a bit, it's just like Genesis in many ways, or the Old Testament, probably the first three or four books, up to Deuteronomy or whatever. It's that kind of level of complexity in terms of ideological precepts, theoretical precepts, theological precepts. About the beginning of the world, the beginning of different species. And so she was saying I should go that far, but I'd already gone much, much further. So I never saw the teachers as the ultimate in terms of knowledge and understanding. I always saw that they were on a different part of the journey, but never that they were the ultimate. And in many... So my understanding of things is slightly different. And this doesn't come from a parental thing, because my parents are quite traditionally Christian, conservative, with a small c, and they're not going to be the ones that are pursuing. It's just something inside of me. In fact, I remember reading lots of books and having to hide them under my bed. Hiding them under the bed because, you know, why are you reading that? That's not part of what you need to read. If it's, and they would say, you know, read the Bible, because that gives you your religious principle, and read the school books that they've told you to read. And I was interested, I'll read the Bible, I'll read the school, but then I also read the Quran, I also read the Dead Sea Scrolls, I also read this, and I'll read beyond that, because I have a genuine interest in it. So I'd be up till 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning reading, just because.
So what was your relationship then with your fellow pupils in that regard? Because it sounds as though you were on a very different plane.
I was distant to them, most of them, because many of them were pursuing knowledge for qualification purposes or pursuing it because they have to get through to get a job. So my goal was neither. Mine was the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake. So my perspective was completely different. And it still is now, because even many academic colleagues are not pursuing knowledge for knowledge's sake. It's for them, it's the job, something that they have to do. So, and yet there's a difference there. So the division is, it's quite a stark division.
And have you kept in touch with any of those, either the teachers or the pupils?
No. The teacher, I think, you had the most impact on me. She was an interesting woman, very diminutive in size. She had purple hair. She believed that women should never wear trousers, that they should always wear skirts. She carried a handbag like Margaret Thatcher, and a little small handbag. I'm sure there was nothing in it, but she carried this little small handbag. She was never dressed in a dowdy or ordinary fashion. She always was dressed as if she was going to the theatre, which is the best example that I can give. She was quite an extreme right-wing person, member of the Women's Institute, staunchly conservative of a big C and a small C. Quite an avid lover of the British Empire, and yet one of the most fantastic teachers I've ever had. She taught English. She was traditional in her teaching, and yet she had read extraordinarily wisely, and wisely and widely, so that even though she taught a traditional curriculum, she had the capacity, upon engagement, to talk about a plethora of information and knowledge, which was hitherto missing from many of her counterparts. She is, without doubt, the most influential teacher to me.
And do you find that when you're teaching now, in some way, are you reminded of some of those earlier experiences? I mean, I very much am aware of, I mean, for good and bad sometimes, you're aware that, you know, this is how I was taught 25 years ago. Sometimes you want to emulate those people because you thought, well, you know, that those are the go-to people. But as you get a bit older, a bit wiser, sometimes you start to realise that that may be stuck in a vacuum, and what was right in 1986 may not be right in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit earlier than 1986. Say 1984, 83. So that I don't emulate her process, but I'm always in gratitude for what that process has done to my development. Yeah. I found that there were better ways of teaching than the ways in which she taught. Yeah. But nevertheless, I'm intensely gracious for what she has given me and other teachers like her. I had another teacher, remain nameless, who taught me politics, A-level politics. He was also very staunchly right-wing. Never wore trainers, always wore smartly shined black shoes. Always wore a suit and tie and shirt. Always had a short back and sides. Was a great lover of empire. Loved the idea of empire. Always used to say that, wrongly actually, the Nazis were wrong. They were bad, but the trains ran on time. You know, that was always his line that he used to say. And yet he also was an immensely fantastic teacher. Immensely fantastic teacher. He put me to one side and say, I actually don't agree with this, but Onyeka, you might like to look at blah, 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 blah. I don't agree with a word they're saying, mind you, but you're the type of person who would benefit from reading blah, 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 blah. Yeah. I don't agree with them. Yeah. Yeah. So immensely useful and immensely helpful person. And these people that I just named, the two of them, were immensely curious about me. And that's perhaps the difference that we get now, in that sometimes in our pursuit to treat everybody differently, we are not allowed to almost individually mentor a student that has a particular kind of spark. Whereas in the past, they looked for individual people who had a particular kind of spark, who would become an Einstein or an Isaac Newton or whomever, a Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, that type of person, or an Anne Bronte or someone like that. They would often look for somebody like that, to the detriment of everybody else, in Absolutely. Fact. But now we're not allowed to do that. So often that's why people say, well, where are the great thinkers now? Where are the people who are going to? And often it's because, you know, that's not what the education system is actually about now. But in the past, it was like that. And I was one of those people that didn't perhaps come from one of the demographics that they would be expecting. I certainly didn't fit into the demographics that they were expecting. Not public school educated, you know, not upper class, not white, you know, a white, you know, middle class male. I didn't fit into that category. And yet, I was definitely in inquiry and pursuit like that kind of thing. So I guess I would be an anomaly, but they were immensely curious, why is this small child of African Caribbean heritage, well, why is he interested in this, how can it be, you know, what's this about, why is he interested in that instead of playing hop, skip and jump, and why is he interested in that more than he's interested in sport, what's that about? And we must remember, in many ways, this is 82, 83, 79. It's a very different world from the world that exists now. There weren't... You didn't see people of colour, really, on TV, except Lenny Henry. You know, or you just didn't see it. Or unless they were Americans, perhaps. You didn't see educators. I think Stuart Hall was the only professor of African Caribbean heritage that you'd ever see. Late 70s, early 80s, you just didn't see him. So their interest was, okay, this is interesting. Let's see where that goes. Let's see where that goes. So as I said, that old system of education has immense drawbacks, but there's also immense benefits. And I also think in terms of the hurdles that I've had to jump going through that system and afterwards, you know, getting my degree, postgraduate, master's, PhD, all those different things, and I've had to jump through a lot of hurdles and take on a lot of academic angst. I think that in some ways that education was actually helpful in me overcoming those late obstacles.
Yeah. And I think that sort of reflection, I've always kept a diary.
Yes.
But I think it's, and often, of course, I'm wrong-footed by something that you conflate particular periods of your life, that sort of thing. But I think sometimes it's when you step away from the actual content of what you're being taught and actually ask those why questions. Why are we being taught this? Or how does this fit in? Why are we enjoying this more than something else? And I think those sort of questions can sometimes, in terms of an impetus to do, for example, a PhD, you need to have that degree of reflection.
Yeah, you do.
It sounds like you've got that in spades. I mean, you mentioned Lenny Henry, and something I wanted to move on to was other influences, cultural influences. I know when we had a telephone conversation a few weeks ago while arranging this interview today, we were talking about music in the charts and how formative that is. I mean, was that something that was particularly important growing up?
Very much so. I think, there are a few people who were immensely influential, slightly eclectic in my development. One of them was the actor Richard Burton. A second was the African-American singer, political activist, composer and intellect, as civil rights leader Paul Robeson. Third was the African activist and campaigner George Jackson. Going in progressive order. So Richard Burton was, I think, the first person who inspired me, especially with his readings of Dylan Thomas.
Under Milkwood.
Under Milkwood. In the written word, the sound of the language. And I was always fascinated by the fact that Richard Burton learned Welsh first. Welsh was his first language, and English was his second language. That meant that he was always coming to English from a secondary perspective with a fresh mind, and his pronunciations were entirely different from somebody like Laurence Olivier, who, though come from a working-class background, had English as a first language. And I always felt that the way in which Richard Burton resonated with the language, it acted as a translator, which I immediately understood. And I understood Shakespeare and Under Milkwood and all those things through Burton's cadence more clearer than I did through Laurence Olivier's cadence. So, and his perceptions on the world, because Richard Burton was also a political activist. He was a communist, a left-wing person who believed in civil rights, which he sort of kept out of the public eye, because in the public eye it was all about his relationship with Elizabeth Taylor, his drunkenness and everything else. But in fact, he was an humanitarian. He was many other things apart from that sort of persona that we have of him. And I was always fascinated by Richard Burton. I was always fascinated by his performances, even when he was in the most hokey-cokey films, like the Medusa Touch.
Yeah.
His performance for me, his presence, and the fact that so much positive energy could be released through a human body. Yeah. I was interested, fascinated by the concept that energy, divine energy, light, could be reflected through a human voice and a human persona, and could be receivable by another human being, and a human person could act as a diviner through which energy could flow. And Richard Burton personified that with his voice alone, let alone anything else. So I was immensely fascinated by that. And in a similar way, Paul Robeson, this is a person who has a voice that seems beyond human, even in ordinary conversation. I don't know quite how deep it is, if there's a register, but if it is, it must be way down on the register, even in ordinary conversation. This is a man that resonates a deep, melodious capacity, and also he's a polyglot too. Someone that could learn all these different languages, Russian, Mandarin, and all these languages, and could learn languages instinctively. He was a multi-genius, a remarkably astute, intelligent person who was a civil rights activist before it became fashionable to become a civil rights activist, devoutly believing in the human spirit and the human integrity and the oneness of the humanity, and yet also completely defiant in opposing the historical transgressions that, in his case, the United States of America have committed against people of African descent, and colonialism and imperialism has committed against not only people of African descent but all people of colour throughout the world. So he was my first route in. And then I was immensely curious with the activist and campaigner George Jackson, for not for the reasons that people think, but in the sense of his defiance against an attempt to dehumanize him in his own eyes. Because I feel that once you you being in prison for over almost two decades as Nelson Mandela was, but the difference is with George Jackson's perception is that George Jackson never got that same notoriety that Nelson Mandela was likely to get. He spent most of his prison life in obscurity, and I'm always fascinated by that when a whole state or a whole system decides it's going to dehumanize a human personality, how that human personality fights back and says, no, I'm a human being, how they assert that humanity. And I remember watching old footage of George Jackson talking very calmly. This man was brutalized every day, put in solitary confinement, brutally, savagely beaten, and yet he spoke with such softness, power, cadence, courage, and I always admire that. I always admire that kind of personal defiance, spiritual defiance against the odds. So those three individuals, others too, those three individuals really inspired me in many ways.
Yeah, no, it is extraordinary because, I mean, I remember reading Mandela's autobiography, and it's a mixture of, well, if he hadn't suffered, he wouldn't be the emblem, the beacon of hope that he is now.
Yes.
But that doesn't justify what happened.
No.
But at least, this is also a big thing in terms of the nostalgia project, in terms of where we go from here, that nobody wants to go back to what happened then.
Yes.
But at least you can say, well, he showed that no matter how much you're beaten down, you can. There can be a spirit of hope, of reconciliation.
Indeed.
I mean, his election, he was, 74? Maybe even slightly younger when he became South African president.
Yes.
I mean, that was, the symbolism was so remarkable.
Yes.
We were all sort of 19, 20-year-old university students at the time. I remember watching his inauguration with this sort of sense of almost disbelief. Because I remember, not too many years earlier, remember the special, is it the special AKM, Nelson Mandela? And thinking, that journey from there to here, it felt kind of surreal, but also you sort of know you're in the presence of something that was as close to divinity as you're going to find in human form.
I think that the perhaps human beings look for individuals who've been through immense odds and difficulties to inspire us to the best of our humanity. But when you are Nelson Mandela suffering in a prison cell in obscurity, being beaten, because I'm sure he was beaten. We don't see that, he doesn't talk about that much, but I'm sure that must have happened regularly, certainly in the first 4 or 5 or 6 years. You can't necessarily see that, but there's just something in you, the best of us, the best of humanity, that keeps you going. It wouldn't be anger and hate, because anger and hate are not strong enough to keep you going that long. Anger and hate are strong, mind you, but they're not strong enough. Strongest thing is love. Love is stronger than anger or hate. But so you need actually love to persevere that long. It may start out as anger and hate, even for the first 5, 6, 7 years. After that, you have to turn it into something else. After 8, 9, 10, 20 years, you have to turn it into something. It has to be love, because love is the only thing that's strong enough to keep you going. And when you run out of love, you run out of strength. You lose it.
I agree. I think there's an important role for the way we assimilate things, because I find, maybe I'm lucky in this regard, that I've always had an outlet for any kind of chaos in my life through a diary, because that's when it's my voice. Nobody else can dilute it or compromise it. And in a way, there's a degree of self-reflection there, which sometimes you may not have when you're in interpersonal communication, where somebody is taking away your voice.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. And certain that can happen in personal relationships. Yeah. It can happen with colleagues. You just kind of feel, I seem to have no voice. Or I've got periods in my life when I thought, why am I stuttering and stammering? Why can't I finish a sentence?
Yes.
Then I'd be teaching my students, thinking, no, I'm fine. So the so there's something about the context. You're thinking, well, in this context, something, I have a voice. In that situation, I don't. So I think that sometimes being able to assimilate that kind of process is part of that healing journey, which I guess to different degrees everybody finds themselves on.
Yeah, that is a universal question of need for expression, I think that children in particular should be allowed to express in artwork even that which adults may find perverse, strange, or peculiar. Children, adults also should be able to, in their art, release that which is inside of them, which others may also find objectionable, because they are releasing it through artwork. So as long as they're not harming anybody, and that release is necessary, not holding in, but letting go is absolutely necessary. And sometimes I'm afraid that in our pursuit towards correctness, that we've lost that capacity to express even that which is objectionable. But we need to find ways that people can express even that which is objectionable, but in a way which doesn't hurt others. We need to find ways to do that, because otherwise, simply because people aren't expressing it, it doesn't mean it's not there. It just means it's not being expressed. And we think, oh, we've moved forward, but people aren't expressing this. They are feeling it. They feel it inside. And simply because they don't express it doesn't mean they don't feel it. We have to find ways that they can express it. That doesn't harm others.
And for you, would that be through publications, teaching, anything?
Anything. Yeah. I don't know what it is. Yeah. It depends on the person. I don't know. But we need to find ways to do it.
Yeah, and also that
we need to do it right now.
Absolutely. Well, indeed, because I mean that question of masks is what you mentioned, Richard Burton. I mean, I didn't realise. I mean, obviously he's from not far away from where I was born.
Yes,
in South Wales.
South Wales.
Oh, fantastic. So absolutely, So and Paul Robeson, of course, did play.
Yeah, of course.
Not How Green Is My Valley, but certainly my grandfather at his funeral wanted. When you come to the end of a perfect day.
Okay,
That was the funeral side. But something I just wanted to turn to, because, I mean, politics and religion perhaps is something you mentioned there in terms of the teachers. It's very interesting that I'm guessing that with those teachers who didn't reveal their political sense of... you obviously knew that you were taught by quite right-wing, conservative, with a small set of teachers. Were they blatant about that?
Yes.
How interesting.
Very, very blatant. Very upfront about it. Very upfront.
Yeah.
I'm eternally glad, grateful for it.
Yeah.
Very upfront.
Yeah.
Very upfront, very obvious. And let me know. And other teachers said, well, why are you working with them? I said, because they have immense knowledge and understanding, and they've been upfront with me.
Yeah.
And they would, whereas others who might have pretended a kind of liberalism often didn't have knowledge or interest or desire. It was mostly the right wing.
I have found as well, I find sometimes with some of the great, radio is a huge passion of mine, but some of my go-to people, some of those heroes from yesteryear, are often very right-wing.
You see it with
comedians as well. He's not a role model, but I've seen Jim Davidson as well.
Okay, yes.
And that is just remarkable, because I think, is he wearing a mask? Is this acting? I don't know.
Yes, yes.
But I'm thinking in terms of radio presenters, Tony Blackburn, Ed Stewart,
who are
quite right-wing sensibilities. Well, they've certainly been associated with the Conservative Party.
Right.
Ed Stewart was very much a voter in the past, and Tony Blackburn's autobiography is very interesting in terms of his views on capital punishment, but it feels very sort of ill-informed. For somebody who's very good at what he does,
indeed.
Step outside your comfort zone, it's very binary.
Indeed.
But I find that curious, that sometimes you admire somebody for their craft.
Yes.
But step away from that. If you meet, that's perhaps the classic question. If you meet one of your heroes, you then find, and I've done that with filmmakers sometimes, and you think they're not quite as exceptional as I was expecting them to be.
Because we're expecting them to be exceptional human beings.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily they're exceptional at their craft.
Yeah.
Their craft that gives the expression of humanity.
Yeah.
It's like David Lean. I'm sure David Lean was the most objectionable person to live with, misogynistic in probably every way possible. But his craft, he's the most immensely powerful person. People would say, actors would say, when he was on set, what a horrible person.
Yeah.
when he's offset and he's away back in his country home, then he's himself. But horrible person, but his craft, I'm sure Marlon Brando, from everything that I've read about him as a person, he's not a very nice person at all, but his craft, his ability, what he produces. Picasso the same way. These people have an ability to produce something, create something, and that's their what they deliver. Albert Einstein, I'm sure, was impossible to live with. But he was, you know, someone without, who probably, like somebody with Asperger's syndrome, who was probably quite difficult to be with, extraordinarily difficult to be with, but nevertheless his contribution to the human expression.
And I find that with politicians, that sometimes when you have, we've just had a general election over in Britain, but sometimes those politicians, even if you dislike where they come from, they often tend to do quite well. It's the wibbly wobbly politicians, the ones who try to appeal to everybody, they end up appealing to nobody.
That's right.
And they're the ones who are very swiftly forgotten.
Yes, they are.
And I think the ones who polarise people are often the ones who tend then to go down in the history,
because they punctuate the human expression, and it's the capacity to punctuate. It doesn't matter, I don't think whether it's left or right is not the issue. It's the capacity of your belief to punctuate the human expression, and whether you believe in it. You see, you can have someone like Che Guevara, who is left leaning, and he punctuates international human expression, which is why he's deified in many ways. Now, he's very left wing. You know, he's an international Republican. He's an anti-American, anti-capitalist, global sort of war hero, if you like, because he spent time in the Congo, he spent time in Africa, he spent time in Central America, he spent time, you know, trying to start revolutions all over the world, and he's become a symbol for such. Because of his commitment to that, however you may feel about that, his commitment to that means that it punctuates the human expression, rightly or wrongly. And in the same way, a right-wing politician who absolutely believes in what they are doing, it punctuates our expression. Those that don't believe don't punctuate. It doesn't have that same resonance. They don't believe in it. And we can kind of feel it. We can sense it. It is that commitment and that devotion to a cause that some people might say is radicalism. And it is a kind of radicalism. But that commitment actually makes us draw in, makes us believe, makes us listen, makes us be concerned.
Now, I've got a few more philosophically based questions as we start to wrap up, Onyeka. I was just thinking, would you say your memories are predominantly positive as you survey your whole life?
That's
and
a good
career.
Question. I'm not sure that my memories are entirely I'm not sure that they are mostly positive.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say so.
Because I guess
there are positive memories, but they're of small things. I'd say mostly positive memories that punctuate mostly the other thing. But those other things I've drawn energy from, if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
To draw energy from the negative.
Yeah. Well, actually, that was my next question about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. I guess we've touched on that in what we were saying about Nelson Mandela.
I think that the negative experiences are the reason why I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that idea of having to fight against something spiritually is what makes you, either it defeats you or it makes you stronger. I can't think in terms of the punctuation of the human expression of a single person that hasn't had to overcome immense, often physical, mental and spiritual difficulties in creating their power, that power that they have, that changes things and changes situations. Those that have been born into something don't tend to be those that we remember. We remember those that change things because they had to overcome. Yeah. And it's what they had to overcome that makes what they do so strong. You know, steel sharpens steel.
Yeah.
So that cauldron of difficulty and overcoming those helped to sharpen the internal aspects of their being that makes what they do have profundity. It has profundity because it has been fashioned from that harsh environment. So, but it is how you respond to that harsh environment. You can respond to that harsh environment by assimilating it as you, and you become like it, and therefore you don't rise above it.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about an ability perhaps to critique it and transcend it.
Yeah. I find it works on a micro level and a macro level at the same time. Because, I mean, we're about to head for the Christmas holiday, and there's that sometimes that expectation, you find it with holidays as well, that sort of says, oh, well, I'm going to do nothing, I'm going to sit, you know, I can't do that, I always need to be on the go.
Indeed.
But there's this still ideal of somehow having the stillness.
Yeah.
And you know what it's like sometimes when you're running, heading towards, say, a Christmas period, when you're doing more work, you feel a degree of stress, and you sort of think, but these are petty things, and in the scheme of things, worrying about a batch of essay marking, it's crazy. But it's those little things sometimes that cause the greatest amount of upset on in a very parochial context. You look at the wider picture and you think, gosh, you know, look at climate change, you look at all manner of things that sometimes feel like they're outside our control. And how do we manage
relative.
That micro-macro disjuncture?
I think the human capacity is a... Our human worries are relative. It's relative. Your fears, your emotions, your angst is relative to your own experience and your own understanding. And for some people, it is, where's my next meal coming from?
Yeah. Absolutely.
For others, have I got enough money to get on this bus that's just about to leave? I might not have enough money. And others might be, I don't know what I'm going to do tomorrow. I've got enough money for today, but I haven't got enough money for tomorrow. And those concerns are not trivial, they're absolutely fundamental to that person. Another person might be, that well that was giving us water has just dried out, what is our whole community going to do?
Yeah.
Other people, it might be, what happens when the Janjaweed comes around the corner, as they are liable to next week, what would happen then? Other people might be, where am I going to buy my next hair? I want to buy hair, I haven't got enough money to buy hair, I need to buy some good hair for my... Otherwise, I don't know how I'm going to manage if I don't get good hair. Our concerns are relative. Who is to analyse? Who is to analyse whether or what concerns are important from what are not important? I don't know. We hope, as academics, that people will at least be more interested in those concerns. That are not just always micro.
Yeah, absolutely.
There is a belief that, okay, you will have micro concerns, but also that you'd have a capacity to understand macro concerns.
I think that's also an impetus for these interviews, because in my corridor with colleagues, we're always talking about the micro level. Oh, we've got this batch of thing, you know, we've got this deadline, we've got this flurry of emails.
Yeah.
But wider picture, you think some people, you know, have such visions,
indeed,
such a sense of...
Yeah.
An innate often sense of serenity profundity.
That's
and
right.
You think, you know, that's what we should be tapping, that's what we should be talking about more.
But in a way, there's horses for courses. Some horses will just run round a course without an understanding that they're just running round in a circle. Other horses have to be free and have to jump the fence and realise that the whole world they could run round if they wanted to. And there are different horses for courses. Some have blinkers on and cannot see beyond, you know, like the pit pony that just goes back and forth down the same path.
Well, I've got a couple more questions. One of them is whether, I hinted at this earlier, your teenage self would be very surprised to see what you're doing now. And I guess it works both ways. What would you say to your teenage self? That whole sort of question of whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young. You know, that sort of, do you have a conversation with your younger self?
Yeah, all the time. It depends, I think. It depends what you mean by your teenage self. Yeah. It could be 11.
Yeah. Well, 12, I normally 13. Randomly say 15.
Okay. But, well, if you're saying 15.
Yeah.
My teenage self at 15. I think my teenage self at 15. No, I had certain perspectives, certain things that I wanted to do, but that was never. Quite modest, actually, desires at 15 or 14 / 15. 16's different.
Yeah.
14, 15. Quite modest things about what I wanted to do. I wanted to teach law and be a lawyer, all of which I do and incorporate within my history. So that would be probably a sense of fulfillment of that. But 16 is a different kind of perspective, I think. And 17, even more, 18, 19, these are all teenage years, quite a different perspective. And each year would be, and even half year, have a slightly different take on where I am now. Some of those people, if I can say, some of those teenage people, some of those teenage versions of myself, would be actually quite shocked what I now am, and some would be quite disdainful.
Because you're not really in touch with them, are you? As we were,
my teenage self.
You're the people who were around your teenage self. Are you in touch with many friends from your past?
Not really, no. One or two people.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah,
one or two people. Not to bring another light into it, a lot of people, not a lot, but quite a number, people that I grew up with are now dead. What's often not known outside African Caribbean community is the mortality rate, suicide, murder, mental incarceration, prison, those sorts of things are very constant and frequent things that take place. So about one in six of the people that I grew up with from the age of about 18 to 25, at least one in six of those people are no longer with us for me to have a conversation like that with them. So this is simply not there.
Extraordinary. And where, one of the questions I should have asked earlier on, where did you grow up?
Oh, in several places at the same time. So in Basingstoke, West Sussex, Surrey, South London, North London, Leeds, Sheffield. The teenage years that we were talking about, Basingstoke, born in London, but raised in Basingstoke, and then West Sussex, and then Surrey. And then South London. So those would be the childhood part.
Extraordinary. I mean, I've got family members who've never left the city. They never see each other because they're on the east side of Cardiff or the west side of Cardiff.
Yes.
And I think, well, I'm in Canterbury. I have more contact.
Indeed.
You do. So it's all relative. Yeah. My very last question, though, on your career is: are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, definitely looking forward person. But one also needs to look backwards to go forward.
That is the most perfect answer. But on that bombshell, an absolute privilege because you invited me here to Wood Green today. Yes. And thank you so much. Yes. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.